Hello and welcome to this, the latest podcast in an ongoing series from the Institute of Leadership and Management, where we review topical news stories which have a leadership and management theme. Today's stories cover the period up to the 12th of February 2020. My name's Nick Scott and I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute, and I'm joined today by the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards, Kate Cooper. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
Finnish politicians made the newsstands this week when Health and Social Affairs Minister Aino Keizer-Pekonen announced bold reforms to parental leave policy. Now providing equal entitlement to fathers and mothers, overall allowances have grown to 14 months, with each parent receiving an equal allowance exceeding 160 days. Pekonen noted the revamped policy signals a major change in positioning, with more time allowed in total, and also in a more flexible form, with parents able to pool and redistribute these time away from work allowances, in addition to the now equal treatment by gender. Citing the need for greater family friendliness in workplace attitudes, she invited employers to join government in this changed approach and look for means by which it's genuinely possible to combine work and family life. So, Kate, what can the rest of us learn from these Finnish initiatives?
Well, I've been invited onto the BBC a couple of times to talk about the poor take-up of parental leave in the UK. And one of the reasons that has been put forward for this is the very nature of the leave on offer. Apart from the low level of compensation, it's also to be shared. It's a zero sum. So if one partner gets days off, there isn't anything left for the other partner. And the Finnish initiative here has really addressed that, recognising that parenting is at least a two-person job. In my own view is actually with a new baby for the first time, it's often a three-person job. It is a big change, a big disruption in the lives of those two people. And they need time to settle into new ways of being together, being a new family, and then incorporating work into that new regime, as it were. So companies that recognise that both parents have childcare responsibilities, and this is helped so much by fair parental leave and family-friendly businesses recognising all the demands on their employees' times, are going to be the best places to work.
Former Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger, writing on website Courts at Work, queried the need for CEOs to become moral philosophers. He stated that it's no longer enough to simply be responsible for business performance criteria, arguing that a business leader is also accountable for the company's position on a swathe of social issues that are dividing societies across the world. He concludes that having principles isn't cheap and thus advocates a type of middle-of-the-road Swiss-style neutrality. However, he goes on to cite a wide range of topical issues, including Brexit, hashtag MeToo, tax avoidance, child labour, ethical supply chains and environmental degradation, amongst others, all of which impact upon stakeholders, including employees to various degrees. Noting that today's political and cultural climate often leads to more polarised outcomes, he argues that the neutral middle ground is being squeezed out, and for many, not having an explicit position is seen as actually as defining as coming out for a particular position. So, Kate, is Swiss-style neutrality still a viable position for business leaders to adopt, or do we have to take a stand?
I think there are two main issues here. There have been increasing calls for a more authentic style of leadership, greater recognition of being true to your values, bringing yourself to work. Evidence suggests that millennials in particular are looking for this authenticity from their leaders and managers. So if that is being expected of leaders in organisations, very difficult, I think, to take a neutral, impartial position about so many things that are so value driven. So that's one challenge. The other challenge is, I think, immediately the juxtaposition of doing the right thing and how expensive that is immediately raised. Actually, in the longer term, doing the right thing, sustainable supply chains, making sure every stakeholder who's involved with your business is adequately and fairly rewarded and treated well. That is the path to sustainable business. So in the very short term, it might be by switching to a more ethical supplier or by losing a partner whose values do not align with your own, might seem to give immediately a loss or some economic cost. Actually, in the longer term, you're sending messages about values, not only to your customers, but also to those important people that you want to join your organisation, enjoy working for your organisation and stay there.
Well, picking up again a story we featured last week, it seems that 3/4 of those working in alternative employment models, known collectively as the gig economy, they're happy with their contract employment role. The 2020 Pulse of Talent survey by global human capital outfit Ceridian found respondents particularly praising interesting work, flexibility and good working relationships as the main positives. Less positively, however, the same 500-plus gig workers, when interviewed, saw low pay and weak benefits, along with the absence of job security, as the worst aspects of their work environment. With only around 1/4 of SMEs offering flexible working arrangements, and even fewer offering employment assistance programs, how should employers address these changing labour market dynamics?
As we heard last week, there have been calls for increased regulation of gig workers, really a movement to ensure that they're treated fairly. But the issue here really relates, I would say, more to the previous piece about the morality of organisations, because gig workers, just like full-time employees, part-time employees, suppliers, customers, are stakeholders in your organisation, and you want to treat them well, or you should want to treat them well, if you want that partnership to be enduring and mutually beneficial. So you still want to treat them well because you want to be the gig worker employer of choice. And you can only do that by knowing them, understanding them, recognising and respecting that freedom. And I think that's really important. If you have a great gig worker working for you, they are going to be sought after. They're not going to be available to you as a full-time employee would be. And that's the thing you have to keep on managing. Make it attractive to work with you and be realistic about the demands you make of those people.
A new study by health insurance company Cigna, reported by consultants Korn Ferry, claims that around 3/4 of millennials and Gen Z workers feel lonely and isolated at work. The survey of more than 10,000 people found that young workers cite the need to hide their true selves and the apparent disconnect between their own values and those of their employers as the main reasons for feeling empty or alienated in the workplace. Melissa Swift of Korn Ferry says that a typical workday practices, such as open plan offices and back-to-back meetings, don't leave much time for ad hoc interactions. What more can leaders and managers do to address these concerns?
It's interesting, isn't it, that the technology is a double-edged sword. It would appear that initially it's a way of connecting with people, certainly in terms of remote working, distributed teams. That very technological connection is obviously not a substitute for all of us for the real social connection of being in the same physical space with somebody and having a conversation. And we know through work on conversation that when you start talking to somebody, your rhythms align and that there is a sense of connection, and we're not getting that or not able to get that, certainly yet anyway, through technology. As you say, those back-to-back meetings, if you go from one meeting to the next, often perhaps with many of the same people, there's not much time to chat, to form those social bonds that our research, which we just published a couple of weeks ago, New Decade, New Direction, highlighted that for 77% of the over 2,000 people who responded, relationships with colleagues was one of the key reasons that they stayed in their jobs. So Not only is this a social concern in terms of isolation of these young people and the impact that that will have on their mental health, but it's also a strong business case, isn't there, for actually saying, if you like your colleagues and you enjoy working with them, we're going to keep you. So the challenge, I think, there, of course, for leaders and managers is how do we support that social time and recognise that it's important social time and it's not time wasting.
Well, thanks very much for those observations, Kate. However, sadly, that's all we have time for this week. Please subscribe to this podcast series and check out other topical issues reported on the News and Views section of the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. We'll be back with more news events with the leadership and management theme next week. Thanks for listening.